this is the problem with reviewing. If you start enjoying the music too much, I guess that's a good thing, right? That means it sounds great. You're enjoying the music. Your notes get a bit scrappy, and you know, then you have another drink, and then And welcome back to Not an Audiophile, the podcast. This is episode 39, season 2. And it's our first birthday. A lot of big budget on sound effects around here. It's our first birthday. It's amazing. We made it through the first year. We're pretty happy with ourselves, actually. And there's all sorts of people I'd like to thank. And there's also five guests that surprised me the most with what they had to say on a particular suburb. So that... on a particular suburb, on a particular subject. That's coming up after the Quad 3 integrated review, up now. Are you craving incredible sound? For over 47 years, Len Wallace Audio has been guiding hi-fi enthusiasts on their audio journey. They're not some corporate machine, just a tight-knit crew of audiophiles and entertainment lovers obsessed with great sound. From precision turntables to immersive home theatre systems, they handpick gear that delivers. Stop by the store in Lane Cove, Sydney, Australia, or visit lenwallaceaudio.com. Len Wallace Audio, where your passion finds its sound. Right, and today we have a review on the Quad 3 integrated amplifier, which is it's a very nice amplifier. It looks cool, and that is what caught my eye initially. I guess I kind of always, well, I still admire those early quad amplifiers, all of them really. The later ones, the middling ones, I care less about, but the so ones in the last, I guess, 20 years, nothing wrong with them, but it's those early the 70s, 80s ones, the 33, 303 combo and the probably the 34, is it, and 405 power amp combo. That I kind of like. I've had to repair many of them over the years. They are fairly straightforward to repair. They're built in a way that is, well, quite stunning for their day. Lots of cast aluminium parts, beautifully screwed together in a very elegant way. Such an excellent usage of available space. And clearly the person who designed those was a genius. And of course we know that he was. And the evidence is clear for anyone who's pulled them apart. And interestingly, those earlier quad amps, which were not integrated, they were pre-power combo, unlike the one that we're reviewing today. But it is quad today that is used, in fact, what was a preamp back in the day as a sort of a styling guide for the new integrated. But so finish off on the pre-powers, though. What I liked about them is you could pull them apart very easily. If you wanted to, for whatever reason, dust the insides of your amplifier or check the expansion of the electrolytic capacitors, not that they did that back in the day, they just leaked. They didn't bulge first. You could. Two screws in the case of the preamps, and you would whip the cover off. So, in fact, that's what I did to this one, because one thing that is, well, there's two key things that are very similar to maybe three things. And there's probably about five, there's about 10 things that are almost the same in this new amp as the gear from the 70s and 80s. And I guess one thing straight away is the Class AB transistor output stage, although it's not the current dumping design, but it is. It does use transistors, and it does effectively operate in Class AB, I suppose. At least that's what this one does. The other thing, of course, was the easily removable lid. Now, this lid slid off after the removal of six screws. Now, I was not going to remove the lid and have a peek inside unless it came off easily, because it's not my amplifier. It's been very kindly loaned to me by the Australian distributor of IAG products. Very friendly, generous people, and I wasn't going to put a mark on their machine. When I flipped it over and discovered there was six Phillips head screws to slide the lid off, I thought, nah, let's have a look inside. So I did, and the first thing that I noted, as per the photos we've attached, is the aluminium, a cast aluminium front panel. Wow, That's a serious investment. I like that. It's part of the reason why it looks as good as it does, I think, and looks like the original, because that's what the originals were. So a big nod to IAG for spending some money there and doing a very nice job of it. So this part of the conversation is largely about how it's made. A few other observations, both, you know, good and mediocre. I mean, it's a $3,000 amplifier in Australia. It is not an expensive amplifier these days. You really almost, I mean, really, I think $3,000 is probably the top of the budget end of the market. I mean, and if you take inflation into account, on the basis that in the 80s a $500 amp was a top end of a budget range of a budget, you know, sort of amplifier, and probably, you know, pre-COVID, 1,000, 1,500 was budget, then surely 3,000 now, with the amount of inflation the world has seen recently, is still really, well, just top-end budget. So I'll go with that. It's not really built like a budget amplifier. It's a bit better than that. But there are a few things that will not last forever like the originals. Now, this brings us to a weird conversation. And there's two things I want to say. One is, yeah, they don't build them like they used to. And the second thing is, but neither does anyone else. So it's just the way the world is now. So, for instance, the standby power supply in the Quad 3, much like just about every other amplifier, is a switch mode power supply. And being a switch mode power supply, it will not last forever. Now, no power supply lasts forever. So that's, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it is more of a 10 to 20 year thing than a 15 to 30 year thing. So, and you know, maybe that's being slightly generous in both directions. One doesn't really know. It would depend on how often the amplifier was used, the kind of climate it was living in. Of course, if it's a salty situation, like you live near the surf, then nothing lasts as long. Everyone knows that. So, you know, but it's something you should know going in. And it certainly doesn't matter in the short term. And the reason why they do it, of course, is that it is in fact going to use less current, less standby current, generally run more efficiently and slightly cooler. So why not? It's one less transformer, although really a standby transformer is always quite small. But the reality is, when you look inside this unit, I don't know where they would have put it. So it's efficient usage of space and electricity. The amplifier, as advertised, is clearly Class AB with a pair of big hefty transistors in each channel and a pair of fairly hefty electrolytic capacitors made by Elner. So that's very nice. So 15,000 mic, 50 volts. So interestingly, quite lowish supply rails to the output stage. One guesses that it would work well into 4 ohms on that basis. And so that's probably a good thing. Modern speakers are mostly 4 ohms. IAG would know that, I guess. They make a lot of them. What else to say? The rest of the capacitors are whatever they are. They're run-of-the-mill. Once again, you know, there's no point beating on Quad about the quality of the rest of the capacitors because everyone's using the same. Under $10,000, there's probably, you know, very few exceptions, and I do know of some, and one day we'll perhaps review those products and talk about the differences, but most products have got, you know, adequate parts rather than state-of-the-art spaceship quality bits. But certainly the guts of the output stage is all good quality, and there's a fairly hefty, stout little toroidal transformer in there to run it all. This all goes to explain why the amplifier sounds kind of as nice as it does, I would guess, other than very intelligent design. Seems quite well laid out. Very, once again, efficient usage of space as far as the layout. Overall quality is definitely a solid good, and that's about what you would expect for the money. There's certainly nothing in there where I went, oh dear, you know, so it's nothing like that. It's pretty much exactly what I expected, if not a touch better. And the cast aluminium front panel, the Elner main filtering capacitors, yeah, probably, you know, better than what I expected. And overall, I would say I'm fairly impressed with the way it's screwed together. It's I don't really want to ever have to work on one. It's there's a lot jammed into a small box. But the reality is, I think we've entered the age where when you buy something in this price range, it's never going to get repaired. It's going to work, and it's going to work for, I would estimate, 10, 15 to 20 years, and at that point you will buy another amp. And that's really the difference between the old original quad and the new, because on Monday, as an example, I'll be working on an older one, a 303. I always get confused with the preamps, 33 or 34, because lots of people actually, you know, had that combo. They didn't necessarily have the right preamp. They might have bought it later, bought it used, what have you. When I say right, I mean the matching one of the era. And that amplifier will absolutely be getting fixed. It may take many, many hours, but it will get sorted out and it'll work largely as it did when it was new. But then that's nostalgia to some degree. People want to fix their old gear. We are entering an age when you simply won't be able to, and the same could be said of most things, TVs, cars, etc. There's no modern car that's being driven around in 50 years' time, and unless someone's really paid a king's ransom to keep it going with special technologies, because the original factory parts are all junk and unavailable. March Audio, fantastic amplifiers. Alan March has been on the show a couple of times. He's a great guy, very, very smart cookie, and he manufactures a range of amplifiers and loudspeakers using Purify components in most cases, which we all know are extremely high quality. So check out March Audio, great sound, brilliant build quality and design, and in fact, I believe there is a new preamp, which is a ground-up design of their own, coming out from literally a clean sheet of paper, marchaudio.com. Now, I should point out, in regard to the sound of the Quad 3, that I did listen to it and explored its capabilities and enjoyed it at home for some days before I took the lid off it. So whatever I think of the sound, it's not relevant to what I saw inside. I kind of did that on purpose. I have some notes here on my phone, which is what that noise was. I'm opening it because the reality is, well, the first thing is, it sounds great. It's got a distinctly old school quad pleasantness, slight warmth, a slight sweetness, but only slight. I mean, really, quad never really sounded sweet and warm. Maybe the tube ones did, but the transistor ones were just had this certain rightness to the sound and a slightly dry top end. This is not that. This is a modern version of that. It's a little bit more open in the top. It's silky sweet at times. At least that's the way it strikes me. So I disconnected first I didn't disconnect my name star. I did a weird thing first, because the system was the name star with some active loudspeakers that I'm developing at the moment. So they were a sort of a long-term running-in test prototype speaker, which I guess I'd got quite used to the sound of. So I thought, well, maybe the first thing to do is let's get a feel for how the preamp section of the Quad 3 sounds, because it does have pre-outs, so let's use them. But the trap is using the name as the source, because it's got a streamer in it, of course. Bizarrely, the name does not have any kind of line out in any form, digital or analog. So I used the pre-out at a fixed level, which is, and when I say fixed, I mean a preset level, which I thought, you know, I basically guesstimated what line level would be. It was around, I used 80, just for clarity, out of 100. And that gave a good volume range on the quad. Now, this sounds like a bodgy way to test something, and I think it kind of is, but I wanted to get a taste of the, as I say, of the preamp sound, and then maybe I could draw some conclusions about whether it's the power amp stage in the quad that sounds a particular way or the preamp. So first I listened to the preamp through the active speakers, a Delacorde prototype, and I have to say, immediately, it was a delight. it was preferred to feeding the name straight into the same speakers, which is Interesting. So the bass gained a little bit of, no, I wouldn't say extra weight, but depth and sort of detail, such an overused word, but sort of just, it just had a greater, well, it was more fun. It had a bit more oomph, and it went a little, it didn't go deeper, of course. It just sounded a bit like it did, but it had a slightly, there was a bit more of it. And then the top end, it sweetened a touch. It got a slight silkiness to it. I have to say, I rather liked it. So I ended up listening to that for a day or so, a couple of days, and really quite enjoyed it. So during this testing, I did fiddle with the tilt control. There's a bass adjustment. You can go up a dB or three. Yeah, much preferred it flat. Just sounded right flat. I mean, I guess the speakers are... They're very carefully developed at this stage. They're very, very correct, very well balanced. I guess the name is a reasonably honest sounding, fairly flat sounding amplifier, has its little name, Exuberances. And I think it was quite a nice change to listen to the quad having a slight warmth and a sweetness to it. The name probably doesn't have. So, as I said, I enjoyed that for a while, but fiddle with the functionality of the quad in the process. So I put on a couple of tracks, Gian for the Australian side of, you know, music production, Gian Black Wedding Ring, an oldie, but a goodie, very well-made album. That the album is Gian, it's self-titled. For those who want to look it up, we could probably add it to our Not an Audiophile playlist on Tidal, if anyone still uses Tidal. And it's quite well recorded, but my notes here that there was a tunefulness is the word I was trying to think of before, and a grip to the bass that I really wasn't getting through the name. God knows why. But these are my observations, my oral observations, and it was a touch sweeter, and as I said here, more velvety in the top. So I also put a WTF in there as well after I wrote that. I mean, that's how surprised I was at the time. It was like, why is it doing this? Put on... Poco Glory Bound, it sounded delightful. I was really enjoying it. But the reality was I needed to, after a day or so of that and many tracks, and just using it for TV sound and what have you, I disbanded the name and plugged everything into the quad, connected some passive speakers to the quad, and for the sake of the retro sort of style of a system that I guess that the Quad 3 might be built into, maybe in the IAG stable, you would put a pair of Dentons or, you know, Lintons or something with it. Maybe that's what they're expecting you to do. In this case, I used a pair of Falcon LS35As because that is the most retro speaker I had kicking around the factory. And I have to say it sounded amazing. Now, 35As, they do and they don't need some driving. I mean, they're not very sensitive, so that you kind of need a little bit of power, but they're high impedance, so you know, maybe it's not a match made in heaven, but it was. It sounded delightful. Now, it sounded different to the active speakers through the name, through the quad. I mean, you know, of course it sounded different. Well, the fact is the active speakers are incredibly linear and smooth, and, of course, the LS35As are... in some areas and off axis certainly are. And I was listening to them slightly off axis because that's how you should probably listen to 35As. And it lacked a certain linearity and accuracy, but what it did have was just a lovely bloom and a lovely colour and a lovely, beautiful sound. And so I enjoyed that. And on tunes that are a little dry and the Jeff Lang, Half a Tank of Hope, deeper and more articulate bass, a touch of extra sweetness, that's pleasing to the ear, were the words that I wrote at the time. Slightly more cheerier listening is where the Kurt Elling came in, and a sense of space that's perhaps not always the case in that recording. Lost a little bit of that fast name sound. But overall, I don't know. This is the problem with reviewing. If you start enjoying the music too much, I guess that's a good thing, right? That means it sounds great. You're enjoying the music. Your notes get a bit scrappy, and then you have another drink, and then it all goes to seed. Lindsay Buckingham, Trouble. Well, there's an oldie, but I guess it's a goodie. I mean, it was kind of a hit at the time. It's actually a really interesting piece of music. Lots of layers, typical Buckingham production, I guess. And on a lower resolution system, maybe you don't hear some of that. But I was thoroughly enjoying that. A delight. Once again, on the playlist, have a listen. Compare it on your system. Well, you can compare it. You can only compare it against my words. But be assured, it sounded delightful, yummy, and thoroughly enjoyable. That's what it's meant to do. So what didn't sound good on this quad LS35A combination? Well, clearly it doesn't play at nightclub levels, at tiny speakers and limited amounts of power from the quad, although more than ample, I would say. You could certainly get the full capability of the 35A from this integrated, and I don't know, I didn't feel it was lacking at all. In fact, I actually thought it was a pretty well-balanced system. And just looking at skim through the notes here. Don't you love the bodgy way I do this? Oh, yeah. Maria Muldaur. I've got here, sizzling and oozing through Leadersville. It was a delight. I think I called it a night at that point. It's a good track to finish on. And, it works well with those speakers. Now, I would say on that basis that it would also work well with probably the retro vintage style Wharfdales. And I guess that's what they were angling at. But so you've got your old school 2 cubic foot boxes, your Lintons on short stands, and you've got your old school looking amplifier. You couple that with a turntable and voila, you have a modern day retro system. Doesn't cost all the money in the world. Looks cool. And sounds warm and inviting. I guess that's what a lot of people want. Hey Now Hi-Fi wowed music lovers at the recent StereoNet Hi-Fi and AV show. The Fisher & Fisher loudspeakers, the dome and turntable, the beautiful sounding airtight tube amplifiers from Japan. Now all of this gear, along with Jeff's other rooms that he had fantastic equipment in, is all back at the store, ready for you to listen in store or talk to Jeff about an in-home demo. Jeff, Hey Now Hi-Fi, ring him today. Or email, SMS, maybe smoke signals, pigeons. And the Quad 3 integrated amp review, ergonomics. Okay, not a fan. There's nothing about the ergonomics of this amplifier that I like at all. Volume control feels pretty good, and that works pretty well. And I reckon that's about where it stops. Although the remote does work when you press the buttons. I guess it doesn't. It's not laggy or weird or flaky. But, and it's not just my old eyes that I can't read that display from the couch. Of course I can't. The text is small and it has very little contrast. The light, yeah, you can configure the orange bar to go out, which is lucky because in a darkened, or not darkened, but in a normally, you know, dimly lit listening room late at night, of course it's overly bright, but you can get rid of that. These are not the things I'm referring to. It's things more fundamental, such as the inability to read the display and then putting the volume control up down on the remote on the cursor roundy round button is fine, except lots of us are used to the buttons below that, the up and down buttons on each side of the remote, being probably, in the case of a TV, channel up and down and volume up and down. So quite often you go to turn the volume up or down with, in fact, what is the tilt control, I believe, without grabbing the remote and reminding myself. But, the bottom line is then you don't know how to get the tilt back. You then have to get out of your chair, walk over. I mean, you could guesstimate it from the sound. One would say, hey, we're audio enthusiasts. We would just adjust it to the sound that we thought was correct or preferred. But it's actually subtle enough at the first increment in either direction that it's not immediately obvious, depending on what material you're using at the time. So, You go over and then you find, oh, the bass has been turned up one notch for the last week as well. It's these accidental touchings of those buttons on the remote is kind of annoying. Cause there's no way of knowing, short of walking over and standing a foot or two away from the display, the orange bar, of what it's actually set at. And then, so all of the four rotary controls other than the volume knob are, well, you can't get hold of them. They're set flush into the front, into that beautifully cast front panel. And so you can only adjust them with the lower edge with your thumb, which is quirky and slightly quad. I get all that. But it's kind of just annoying. And so that combined with my other complaint is remote control related again, is that there's no direct selection of source. So let's say you're listening to ARC with the, it's on that input. You're listening to TV and you go, oh, I'm sick of this crap. I'm going to listen to some music. Well, how do you change it? I mean, you literally have to toggle through inputs until you strike some sound, rather than just select, I don't know, audio 1 for your streamer and audio 2 for your CD and audio 3 for your turntable or something, or phono for your turntable, assuming you use the built-in magnetic phono stage. It doesn't work that way. So these are all toggle buttons. And yes, it is the tilt control on the right that is what you accidentally hit, and bass on the left if you sort of forget that the volume is actually on the round button on the remote. And then mute, by the way, people would say it's obvious, it's the top right orange button, yeah, but quite often the mute button is that round button between the volume, which in this case is balance. So then you hit that thinking you're muted, and then you hit another button and you've knocked your balance out. I don't know. Maybe you get used to it, all right? But why do we have to? Why couldn't you just make it to some kind of standard? Not a great fan. Now, one other thing. And I putting the remote down there. One other thing, by the way, all of this clunkiness and what have you is all about us clearly not being AI generated. No one leans away from the microphone and puts the remote down in AI. In the AI world, everything is perfect. So problems. Okay, so quick sum up, and then we'll talk about the problem I had. The looks, I love. The way it's made, very, very good. Very, very much what you'd expect at the price, and maybe a little bit more. No problems there. The sound, delightful. No worries with the sound. You will be happy with this amplifier as far as the way it's made, its likely reliability, and its sound quality. Ergonomically, you'll probably get used to it. I'm just being a bit fussy. Although you probably won't love it. The thing that you may not like is I had troubles with digital sound. On my CD player, the Toslink in was fine. Out of the TV, though, it was choppy. Now, here's what happened, and you can decide for yourself because I don't have the answer. Quad won't have the answer either, I don't think. So we've got a 3 or 4 year old Samsung TV, digital optical out of the TV into the name star, into a, you know, whatever speakers it's connected to. It's been working perfectly for years. It's never chopped, never missed a beat. I take the optical out of the star, plug it into the quad. It immediately, and I've got a recording here and I'm going to play it, it immediately starts chopping. And listen to the demo in a second and you'll know what I mean. It's whatever. It's chopping in and out. It's digitally muting, right? There's something crappy with the stream. Is there? I don't know. The name is happy with it, but the quad not. I thought, I know the answer. I'll plug the ARC in. I've got a HDMI lead there, which I used most recently on the Weem Amp Ultra review. I used that ARC, and it was flawless. In fact, I used it for a number of days, and it was perfect. It certainly didn't chop, or I would have mentioned it in that review. And sort of and we'll hark back to the WIM review. Before the end of this podcast, I want to talk about something I complained about in the WIM, so listen through to that. WIM, WIM, what have you. I listened to my WIM on a whim. Anyhow, the point is, so I put the ARC into the quad. No, it's exactly the same. And in fact, the choppy recording is actually of the ARC. It doesn't really matter. It sounds the same. So, but that is my only complaint. But that is a major complaint. Now, like I say, major complaint in the sense that, well, what the hell do you do? Do I go and buy a new TV? Because I plug the optical back into the name. It's perfect again. Plug it back into the quad. It's choppy. It's choppy all the time, by the way. It's quite intermittent. It could go for 5 minutes without missing a beat, and then it just goes. Anyhow, I'll play the recording right now.
Spot in the grand final. They are saying, the publicans here are saying, it could actually be a bigger weekend than NRL Magic Round. That is when $50 million is injected into Brisbane's economy. Here at the Caxton Street Hotel, they're opening up the car park for the AFL fans. That will be a first. Usually it's just reserved for rugby union and...
Right, you get the idea. That's not enjoyable. So I don't know what the answer to that is. Now, I haven't consulted the Australian importer of Quad about this, because that's not what we do. This is a review of what we've been presented, and this is what I've found. Now, they quite probably will have an answer, and if they do, we will, of course, publish it. So to finish off that sum up of the quad, overall, look, I'm not really appointing brownie points out of 10, but, I mean, it's a thoroughly enjoyable unit. Absolutely enjoyed music through it. I mean, at the core of a basic analog system, this thing is perfect. If you've got a turntable, a pair of Lintons, or some, it doesn't matter what speaker, it doesn't have to be a retro speaker, but I mean, I guess it kind of, that's the look, right? If you've got a house full of, you know, 70s furniture, this is the thing that you want. As far as that, I think it's great. I'm not sure about its digital side because of that experience, because if I had bought this, I think I'd be taking it back. What else am I going to do? If I got to go and buy a new TV, I'd certainly be taking it back and trying another one. And that's what we'll perhaps report about in the future. So don't write it off just yet, but that was my experience. The other thing, the ergonomics, well, yeah, I'm not a fan, but that's me. That's, you know, you would have to try that. That's, you know, your mileage may vary, as they say in the classics. So on a whim, I'm going to talk about the WIM. I complained of the streaming being choppy. We just talked about the quad being choppy on digital in. The WIM was choppy on streaming. Now, what happened was it's a bit strange because I actually listened to two WIMs. The first one at the store was choppy on the internet, and I'm like, oh, the internet's slow, you know, and it was. And we were in the middle of getting it changed to fiber to the premise. So we're like, well, whack the microphone. We'll recheck it when we get the better internet. Because the internet was slow. That's why the body corporate in our industrial estate spent a lot of money changing it to fiber to the premise. Then I had my other sample, which was the actual review sample that the WIM people had given me, plugged it in at home. Bugger me, it does exactly the same. And that's what we reported. It didn't do it on the name. It did do it on the WIM. But then it briefly did it on the name, and it never had. And then we're like, hang on a minute. So we kept the WIM at home a little longer. No, it did it the next day. I'm like, what's going on? So here's the observation. The WIM was more prone to being choppy on streaming than the name, but clearly the internet was at fault. It's just that the name was less sensitive to it. Now, I'm not a digital expert. I happily, you know, I'm an analog guy, I guess, because I don't know. I was brought up in the world of analog. Digital's a slight mystery to me. I'm guessing, though, there is more buffering in the name, so it maybe it comes on a little later, but it's got a little bit more in its back pocket, and therefore it's not running out of buffer, and the WIM does. And at the price, why not? One's 10 times the price of the other, so it's to be expected. Now the postscript is take the same WIM back to the shop. Now we've got fiber to the premise. We've been playing it for background music for 2 weeks. It has not chopped out or missed a beat at any stage. So it's fine. Of course it's fine. Otherwise people will be complaining about it. Except that my guess is, as I've just said, it's a little bit more sensitive to slow internet for streaming than perhaps other units. And we'll leave it at that. The Hi-Fi Shop is the home of quality hi-fi. Experience the best of everything from affordable turntables to not-so-affordable high-end loudspeakers. Let Alex curate a complete system for you or have him using his technical background assist with your next upgrade. Visit in person or check the website hifishop.com.au for easy information on all of your favourite brands. Go straight to the top, speak to Alex at Hi-Fi Shop. And on to our birthday celebrations. Well, what a year. I'm not sure that we thought it would go this well. I mean, you know, it's bragging a little bit, but the show is popular. We have many people to thank for that, which I'd like to do in a second. But I'd like to thank perhaps first the people who tune in and listen. Thank you very much, because I guess you're the most important people, right? I mean, we can sit here and talk into a microphone and conjure up what we think is exciting things to listen to, or at least, you know, mediocre levels of interesting. But is it? And in fact, it's been proven by the people that listen that in ever increasing quantities that, in fact, we do produce a fairly enjoyable show. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And feel free to show your celebratory thanks by, following the show, or, of course, subscribing on our YouTube channel, Non-Audiophile Podcast. Now, many people to thank. I'm going to go first with the ladies. There's only one, and that's Sharon, who does all the real work. I'll keep this brief, by the way. But she does. You know, like, there is so many things to do in a podcast other than talking and recording and even finding guests. I mean, they're kind of the fun bits. And then there's this, all this grunt work that has to be done, of which there is loads of it. And Sharon does all of that very, generously. Speaking of generosity, we have two co-hosts, David Karatsa, Brad Serhan, no particular order. Brad came first. Brad was right there at the start, helping us round up guests, wrangle guests, as I say, convince them of the worth of the show and to come on it. And he did a fantastic job of that and continues to do so with an upcoming episode with a very important Australian hi-fi legend, which we're doing shortly together. So, Brad Serhan, thanks so much for helping getting this started. I almost said getting this started. Well, you know, I did do a little bit of the work. And of course, in more recent times, David Karatsa has come on as a co-host as well, and which is somewhat more convenient because he is local, so we can do in-studio recordings. But David also brings his own flair, charm, and incredible knowledge of hi-fi as well. So, look, between the four of us, myself, Andrew Hutchison, I think we do an okay job, and we, once again, thank you, everybody, for listening. And, of course, we must thank our sponsors who, without their input, financial input, we wouldn't have been able to improve our equipment and, therefore, our sound quality from Season 1 to Season 2. And thanks, therefore, must go to Len Wallace Audio, Cody from Harbottle Subwoofers in Canada, Spectraflora Loudspeakers, and Mark Rushton at StereoNet. So without their help, I could have bought it out of my own pocket, but I didn't want to do that. And, of course, many show supporters, VAF Research springs to mind, Alan March from March Audio, of course, Jeff Haynes from Hey Now Hi-Fi, and Alex from the Hi-Fi Shop. Speaking of Alex, Alex is also on the show as a co-host for an episode, and hopefully he'll be on again as a sort of a, you know, sort of a younger person's, opinion of how things are in hi-fi. Not that he's that young, but, you know, he's younger than the rest of us, all right? Five guests who, what they had to say, surprised me. This is worth listening to. Some are better than others, but these are all tidbits of information, of which there are many more, but these are tidbits of information that I heard, and in some cases, most cases, was genuinely, obviously surprised that this was the case. And so round one, if you like, of the top five surprises of the year would go to Lawrence Dickey, So Lawrence Dickey, well known for designing the Nautilus loudspeakers when he was working for Bowers & Wilkins, or as B&W as I like to say, but that's now illegal. And of course went on to a form with a good friend of his, Vivid Loudspeakers, continuing the organic shape. Now, there's a little snippet of our interview we did with him earlier in the year, where he makes a couple of comments. One, first initially about his tweeter design, which I find impressive. And then we discuss, and I'll cut straight to it, whether there's such a thing as running in.
Millimeter dome drivers. They have this special shape. It's a catenary, and it's a combination of that special catenary shape with this peripheral carbon fiber stiffener doubles the first breakup frequency.
Wow.
So, you know, it...
Wow.
Yeah.
Doubles.
It does, yeah. So when...
So that sends it way out of the audible range, I presume.
40 plus kilohertz. Yes.
Clearly, loudspeaker burn-in is a well understood, or burn-in I feel is the wrong word, but run-in perhaps, of the mechanical parts. I feel less that capacitors have to run in, but the thing
there are no measurable changes is the thing. Okay, somebody says, well, the suspensions have had time to soften up. So, well, if the softer suspension was what we needed, we'd have put a softer suspension. And it's the same with, amplifier running in, what's changing? Well, the resistor values have changed a little bit. Well, again, if a 1.1K resistor was the right value, we would have used
put
it.
One in.
It's not that. And the other thing is, that I find quite mysterious, is if it was things changing value, then half the time it would get worse. Just statistically, it would. Of the time it would, actually, there would be a spread. But there isn't. It only ever seems to get better. Well, nearly only ever seems to get better.
And for our next exciting tidbit of surprise information and tidbit from a previous episode, I should say that the previous excerpt was from our Munich Roundup, episode 29. Now, on to our next one. David Price, episode 36, fairly recent episode, as someone who's, he's a POM, based in the UK for his whole life, he has spent most of his life reviewing hi-fi based in the UK with perhaps, you know, more than his fair share of UK product to listen to. I was a bit surprised about what he has at home.
I absolutely adore modern jazz on Blue Note, sort of, Herbie Hancock and stuff like that. But the music that I generally listen to likes to have kind of clarity and attack.
Okay.
And it has to have bass energy, but it mustn't be overblown. And it's more important for it to be fast than it is to be, voluminous.
Yes.
I'd rather have a live, punchy, taut, tight, low bass than very fulsome, kind of bouncy, you know, kind of soft bass. So for me, the speaker I've ended up with is the Yamaha NS1000M. And that to me just does what I want better than any other speaker I've ever heard.
Okay.
And I've reviewed, you know, so many speakers over the years, high end ones. I've done virtually every 801 B&W and so on as they've come out for the last 25 years and umpteen other very high end speakers. And to me, nothing gets that combination of attributes that I like, you know. So it's like having a motorbike, you know, that you absolutely adore. It could be a Honda Fireblade, and all you want is for it to go fast, stay around corners, you know, stick around corners and power out of bends really smoothly and cleanly, and, you know, stop on a sixpence. So if you identify the things you like, and then you build your system around it, and you also, you have to, I think the most important thing, and this is totally contrary to what people used to say in the UK 40 years ago. They used to say sort of source first, you know, you've got to have a great turntable or whatever. I think you've got to find, it's almost having, you know, I'm not just talking about a set of speakers for the bathroom or whatever. I mean your main speakers. it's almost like a relationship you have with your spouse. You know, it's a serious relationship you have with your speakers, and you basically got to love them for all their vices and stick with them, you know. So
and get the best from them somehow. With what you plug into them.
Indeed. So, but the point is, the kind of a priori, you know, before everything else, choice I think you've got to make with hi-fi, if you're going for your ultimate system, is get the speakers that are right for you.
He also obviously has strong thoughts on the importance of loudspeakers. Our third outtake from a previous episode is another English gentleman, Peter Como. So Peter these days works for IAG, designing umpteen loudspeakers for umpteen brands. He's a very busy man. He has lots of experience and some opinion. You could, as a group, certainly build, one would assume, a very, very competitive high-end product. Is it on the radar?
Well, let me approach it from a different direction, because it's one of the things that really bugs me. And that is, people do not take what a lot of products that our brands do, they do not take them seriously, you know, because they are not expensive.
Yes.
And it drives me crazy, because when we introduced Elysian for Wharfdale, mm-hmm. which was probably the most expensive product that Wharfdale had done for a long time.
Yes.
I remember taking it, going to one of the tours I did to demonstrate, this was in Germany, and at one high-end store in Germany, we put the top of the range, the Elysian falls on, driven by some tube amps, and customers were just coming in to this evening do and having some snacks and drinks and sitting down with a glass of wine and listening to music, and it was great. Everybody was having a great time. Mm-hmm. The speaker sounded fantastic. It was very musical. This whole system was very musical. And it was thoroughly enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And then halfway through the evening, the store owner said, "Can I have a word?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And he took me outside. He took me into another of his den rooms.
Yeah.
And he looked around and he said, "Peter, what do I do with all these speakers now?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're playing something which sounds absolutely incredible. For a third of the price of what I'm looking at in this den room." He said, "But how am I supposed to sell them?" I said, "Look, you're probably going to be selling on brand name anyway, because people do that, right? They come in and they go, 'I want a pair of JBLs or I want a pair of Focals.'"
Yeah.
They're not, you know, they don't come in and ask for a pair of Wharfdales. And that for me is a big problem, because we do like to push boundaries. We are going to be pushing boundaries. For Wharfdale, we are going to go more expensive.
Okay.
But it's still going to be what I would call affordable. We're not going to go crazy.
No.
But it does annoy me that, for example, in Wharfdale, the Elysian series and the Aura series in particular, which I think are phenomenal performers mm-hmm. for their price, don't get taken seriously because they are not expensive enough. And that's crazy, because what we're doing at IAG is we're bringing the economy of building things to a high performance, but at a reasonable price, to the marketplace, so that, like I said, we can get as many speakers into as many homes as possible.
So that was episode 31 of Peter Como. Now for a more local excerpt from Mark Doman. So Mark is rapidly becoming, I would say, you know, to some degree, at least in the performance-orientated high end of the high-end record-playing industry, a bit of a not just a legend, but someone you go to for information on how turntables work. And we did just that. In fact, this episode, the piece I'm going to play is about the issues with vibration and record playback. Well, I think we all know about those when you walk across a timber floor and your stylus either jumps out of the groove or you can certainly hear some subsonic booming. But he's got an interesting reference here to just how big a problem it could be. But what I'm not going to play is all the bits later in the episode where we asked him what was important about setting up a turntable and what were the important aspects of it, you know, cartridge versus arm versus record deck, leads, etc., that you will want to hear. And now the excerpt.
Bunch load of instruments, lasers, if they're doing any laser interferometry, where they shine beams at the various angles and get the reflected energy come back and look at the interference patterns on a screen.
Yes.
They're literally the footfall in the university laboratory or engineering department, typically at the bottom of the building. The Conqueror transmits a lot of vibration. You know, one would think that, hey, I'm on 3 foot thick concrete, that's going to stop anything moving, but turns out a truck on the road on the Western Highway will interfere with your imaging.
Okay.
2 kilometres away.
Two kilometres. So okay.
Yeah. So it's really weird. I mean,
and to wrap up our 5 excerpts from previous episodes that I found interesting is Mike Creek. Some funny things with Mike. He's a very interesting guy. I do enjoy a chat with him, and I have strong memories of the 4040 amplifier, which is what we're talking about in this excerpt, and just how good it sounded, how musical, but how incredibly simple the circuit is. People listening probably don't realise that this amp, as I remember it, sold in the UK once you launched it into the market. Was it for £99?
Correct, including tax.
Including tax.
I think it was probably, yes, which was about 10%, I believe, or 12.5%, something like that.
So, I mean, that sounds outrageously inexpensive for a very serious amp as far as its performance. It was very musical, had adequate power. Mm. It set the scene for your later models, really, as far as the way it sounded, I think. Would you agree with that, or do you feel that it was adequate for the time, or do you think? I mean, what I'm really saying is, do you think one of the reasons
it's adequate?
Well, yeah, that shouldn't be taken perhaps the way it sounded. Mm. But what I meant was, were you just happy with the sound, or were you rather ecstatic with the sound that you'd achieved for what was an incredibly inexpensive retail price?
I have to say that it was stooping a little bit low for me to make something like that when I knew I could make something better.
Yeah.
But I always had a thing for this amplifier that we used for the Windsor amplifier. And although I've been making sort of large MOSFET power amps and preamps, which were very, very complicated as kits for hobbyists to make, which were cutting edge technology, this was the very opposite, you know, the antithesis of what I'd been making before.
Yeah.
But it had a certain something, you know.
Mm.
It had a sound that was very soothing and smooth to listen to, considering, as you say, it was a relatively simple amplifier.
Yep.
The power amp had, let me think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 transistors in total, but the power transistors were Darlingtons. So
oh, were they? Okay. So
they were 2 transistors
saved
in one
couple.
Package.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So 2 Darlingtons a channel and 5 sort of small signal sort of transistors.
No,
and,
no, three small
signal transistors and 2 Darlington outputs. Oh, that's a simple circuit. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's why I said it was 5 in total.
Wow.
Including the Darlingtons, which were operated in class B, and that's no bias, no idle current.
Okay.
Initially, I didn't put any devices in there to try and nudge them into class AB.
Yeah.
But later, we used 2 or even 3 diodes to try to sort of give them a little bit of current to overcome
a sniff of
crossover
current.
Distortion.
So, but okay,
the unusual thing about it was that the Class A driver was 2-stage, well, essentially 2 stages. It was 2 devices, which created an enormous open loop gain. Mm-hmm. And this enormous open loop gain would have been unnecessary if it had not been for the fact that, to simplify the amplifier, I used the open, you know, the high open loop gain closed around two feedback loops, one DC and the other AC.
Right, yeah.
And the AC feedback loop powered or overcame the insertion loss of the tone controls. So I didn't even use a transistor or an op amp for the tone controls. I used the feedback from the power amp to encapsulate it.
Oh, wow. Now I'm even more impressed. I mean, this is actually, that's one of the simplest amplifier designs that includes tone controls probably ever made in production, I would have thought, would it? I mean, because, I mean...
Yes.
Thanks for that, Mike. I want to just thank the guests again. I do want to thank the guests again, and I haven't thanked them all by name because I can't, because we're up to episode 39. Do go to the website and have a look through the various episodes and see whether there's something that, you know, catches your fancy, because there's lots of interesting stuff there. I would like to thank the listeners again, is what I meant to say. And look, thanks for listening to episode 39. We're on to 40 shortly. Next episode is something completely different to this one. I did like the quad amplifier, so I would highly recommend you go to your nearest dealer and have a listen to that. We will report back in the future about the little issue we had, and thank you again for listening. See you in episode 40.